This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Lambert Grimes is Director of the Social Development Department and Ambassador for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands. He's a member of the High-Level Task Force for the International Conference on Population and Development, and he's in Malaysia to attend the International Harm Reduction Conference, which ended today, actually. We're fortunate enough to have him in the studio with us to discuss global challenges on sexual and reproductive health and rights. Welcome to the show, Lambert. How are you today?
Hi, Meera. Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
You're most welcome. This is a topic which we in Malaysia don't really like to talk about. It's always taboo, or it's, you know, people are not comfortable talking about it. But what does sexual and reproductive health rights actually mean? What does it entail?
Well, for me, basically, it's about the right of people, especially young people, to make informed decisions about their own life and the most intimate parts of their own life, like falling in love with someone, start a sexual relationship, getting married, get children. These are very important parts of our life, and we think it's important that people, you know about what they are doing.
And when did this awareness come about in the Netherlands that sexual and reproductive health rights needed to be, you know, given a platform for people to understand? When did that awareness come about?
It's already quite a long time ago. If you think about the importance of reproductive health worldwide, HIV and pregnancy are the two biggest killers for girls worldwide between 15 and 24 years old. The biggest two killers. Imagine you're pregnant and you're born in, say, Niger or Chad or in a poor African country. Then you have a 1 to 7 chance that you will die in pregnancy. That's horrible if you think about that. But HIV is a disease which is actually getting more and more relevant for middle-income countries and also Western European countries, because HIV is concentrating more and more on the so-called key populations, mm-hmm. which are people who use drugs, sex workers, and men who have sex with men. So HIV is not a disease which we can say, look, that's something, you know, for happening in poor and remote countries. No, it's a disease which we see everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's a separate grouping, sexual and reproductive health, as well as health rights. They're two different things, aren't they?
Yeah, well, there's a health perspective and there's a human rights perspective. And we think in the Netherlands that both are very important. Sometimes it's easier to speak about health. Human rights always that will lead up to controversial political debate, which we have in New York and Geneva. But if you look at the ground and if you look at people's lives, then they don't think in terms of rights. They think in terms of needs. Mm-hmm. And that's what I also want to include in my work.
What is your role as the ambassador, as the AIDS ambassador? What do you really do?
We think in the Netherlands, sexual and reproductive health and rights and our support, our contribution to the AIDS response is so important that we need a specific, special person. So I'm the ambassador on this issue for the Netherlands, and I'm traveling a lot, both to the international level, to New York, to Geneva for negotiations on UN resolutions, mm-hmm. but also to countries to get to know what's happening in the world, to share my experience, and also to share experiences which I what I've learned in other countries.
What has been your experience?
Well, I traveled really quite a lot. Of course, I've got my Dutch experience, how we are working and thinking and living in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. What is the Dutch experience? Could you share that?
Okay, let me mention two things. First thing is we have the lowest teenage pregnancy rate in the world. So girls get pregnant in the Netherlands at a relatively high age. The other thing is we have the lowest abortion rate in the world. Of course, they are very much related to each other. Now, how have we realized that situation? I think it's because of a cocktail or a mixture of instruments. One is sexuality education at school. Mm-hmm. I'm very much a believer of in sexuality education at a young age, which is not as some people think, that if you provide sexuality education to a person, a young person, that he or she will immediately start having sex. No, it's actually the other way around. I'm having this argument with many people, mm-hmm. but I really believe in education. The other part of the mixture or the cocktail of instruments is access to services and access to commodities. If you are a young person, or if you are an older person, if you are an adult, and you want to have access to contraceptives, it's important that you have access to contraceptives. In the Netherlands, it's easy to get access to contraceptives, even at a young age. Even, and I know that's a controversial issue, even without parental consent. But we have learned that it's important for young people to take their own decisions, because if we like it or if we don't like it, young people sometimes have sexual relationships even before they are married.
They do. And I'm sure you get a lot of opposition from religious groups, conservative groups. How do you engage with them?
Well, first of all, I don't have the moral authority. I really like to repeat that every time and again. What we can do is share our experience, and our experience is based on evidence. But I do respect and accept other people's religious considerations. Actually, within my ministry last year, we started a course on religion. Of course, we are a secular country and secular ministry, but we want to understand why people have certain religious motivations, and what makes, how does religion have an impact on the discussion we are having at the international level. So it's good for me to understand where religion comes from. I'm religious myself, but I also know quite a few religious people who do want to have access to sexual reproductive health services. An Irish housewife whom I met 2 weeks ago, very Catholic, very religious, said, "I want to be a good Catholic person, but at the same time, I don't want to have more than 2 children. That's a very human question, isn't it?
It is.
And at the same time, she is part of a religion of the Catholic Church, which where the Pope has not yet openly
endorsed
supported contraception. Mm-hmm. So I find it a very human question, actually, and I think there are more questions like that. Dealing with sexual abuse, dealing with abortion, dealing with premarital sexual relationships, dealing with homosexual relationships. These are all things which happen in the world, which we sometimes judge from a moral or from an ethical or from a religious perspective. But as a government official, our position is that we have to deal with them in a pragmatic way and in also respecting people's human rights, and also looking at it from a health perspective. And that's where HIV comes in.
So do you think you've been successful in what you're doing?
In the Netherlands, I think, yes, we have been successful when it comes to young people in particular. The average age of first-time sex in the Netherlands amongst young people is relatively high. And just a small figure, but it's very interesting. Of young people who have sex for the first time in the Netherlands, 4 out of 5 would use a condom, 80%. When I told that figure to my 15-year-old daughter, she said, what about the other 20%? I was proud about the 80%, right? But she was concerned about the other 20%.
Yeah.
And that says something about the way a young person is thinking. And I'm proud about it, because at least she is sufficiently empowered or knowledgeable about the risks and the pleasures of sexual relationships. But on an average, young people don't have a sexual relationship before 70 years in the Netherlands, which is relatively high compared to many other countries.
And these are probably due to the efforts by the department and the ministry.
Yeah, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, of course, is looking particularly at countries beyond the Netherlands, but we use our experience in the Netherlands. At the same time, we're learning a lot from others. We, for instance, have a problem with still 1,100 new cases of HIV in the Netherlands.
Every year.
We are very frustrated about that.
1,100 new cases every year.
Yeah, which maybe at the international level is not so much. There are countries with much higher figures. Yeah. But still, given the fact that this is a country with a good health system and a relatively open culture about sexuality, we don't understand where those 1,100 cases come from. So we are learning a lot from other countries, other cities, Barcelona, San Francisco. No, here in Kuala Lumpur, I'm learning a lot. I've been shown around by the Malaysian AIDS Council. We spoke to officials here in Malaysia, to other NGOs, about the way they are addressing HIV in Malaysia. And I'm impressed, actually, by what has been done by both government and civil society. The number of new cases, what we call HIV incidents, in Malaysia has dropped sharply over the last couple of years. For instance, due to the Malaysian government's involvement in the way they deal with the people who use drugs. We call that harm reduction. Basically, not criminalizing drug use, but offering alternatives like methadone instead of heroin, and providing needle exchange facilities. Malaysia is actually quite good at that, and maybe compared to other countries in the region, really a champion. And I've learned a lot of that.
I'm sure, because we have our transmission is more towards drug users and the exchange of needles. How have the Dutch ministries come together to achieve this? Because it's not just all about your ministry. It's got to include the school system. It's got to include the health system. How do you all be on the same page to solve a problem like this?
Yeah. Sometimes we call that the polder model. It's the way in the Netherlands we like to have a consensus amongst different parties involved, that we put a lot of effort in getting all different ministries, the different levels of government, civil society together. We work a lot through civil society organizations. And taking the example of drug users or sex workers, we as a government, we think we are not the best party to reach these people. Drug users are afraid of government officials. Yes. We know that. So we work through NGOs, very of our community-based organizations, who are much more capable than we are to reach these people, to work with them. And so we provide funding, subsidy, or health advice to these community-based organizations. So in the Netherlands, we have, a good way of cooperation amongst government agencies, as well as other society, civil society organizations.
Yeah. Amsterdam is famed for its red light district, and you are perceived as a progressive force on sexual rights. So we'll come back and find out more about how you have tackled these various groups who are, you know, exposed to HIV AIDS transmission, as well as other sexual and reproductive health issues. Up next, if you have a question for Lambert Grind, send it through. It's 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Live and Learn, and we're discussing global challenges on sexual and reproductive health and rights with Lambert Grinds, the AIDS ambassador at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from the Netherlands. Lambert's actually here, or you are here for the Harm Reduction Conference, which ended today. How did that pan out? How did it go?
It's a very fascinating conference because here there are people from many different countries, in mostly Asia, of course, but also some other countries. And harm reduction is an interesting phenomenon because it is a very pragmatic approach to an issue where people have very strong moral opinions about. So it, on the one hand, it's politicized. People tend to think in terms of drugs are bad, so we need to penalize that and put the people in prison. That's what many governments used to do. But we learned from experience, amongst others in my own country, that it is more effective to not criminalize these people, but to help them, support them, because if you're addicted, it's very, very, very difficult to get rid of that addiction.
And addiction is a disease, really.
Yeah. So, and we know by the HIV epidemics, we've learned that HIV amongst people who use drugs, who inject drugs in particular, because they share sometimes needles, is much higher than amongst other people. So this is a concern. In the Netherlands, we about 30 years ago, we started the harm reduction approach by providing these people shelter, We have drug consumption rooms where they are safe to use drugs, and where they get access to services such as methadone and clean needles. Drugs in Netherlands are illegal. Let me be very firm on that. We are not advocating for a legalization of drugs, but drug use is accepted and is legal, like in quite a few other countries, actually. Mm-hmm.
And your government is comfortable being seen as a hub of sex tourism? I mean, you have very much a reputation. How do you manage that sector of the people?
About sex workers, you
yes.
mean? Yeah, I think it's basically the same idea as behind our approach to drug users. We try to be pragmatic and we try to be health and rights oriented. We liberalized basically our laws on sex work 15 years ago. So if you are a sex worker in the Netherlands, that is a legal profession, but you have to follow certain rules, and especially the owners of the brothels, they have to follow certain rules in terms of safety, fire safety, for instance, also access to sanitary services, condom use, etc. And one very important rule is that the girls and the boys who work in the sex industry need to have a legal permit. So we try to fight trafficking, and the result of this policy has been that the underground world of sex workers now is much smaller than it used to be. So that's the positive side of it. So, and it's easier, and I have seen it with my own eyes. I walked around in the red light district. The result is much easier for health workers, local healthcare workers, to address and to have contact with these girls. Most of them are girls. There are some male sex workers. So they get access to information. They get access to services and to commodities. So HIV amongst sex workers in the Netherlands is very low. It's really very, very low. It's actually not an issue anymore. There still is an issue of illegal sex work by trafficking by girls who have been forced from some countries to get to work in the Netherlands, and we need to be open about that. It's still a problem, and we are trying to tackle it. We have a very strict and very firm policy on that. And that's, I think, what we share with many countries, that sex work in many countries is completely illegal and therefore not so visible.
Yeah.
Very much harder for a government to tackle. But in our case, the number of illegal illegal girls without a work permit is relatively small.
Okay, but the legalization would attract that, isn't it? It's legal, so I can come and work in your country, and that leads to a thriving industry. Is that really what you want?
Well, actually, it was not. It didn't happen that way. The sex industry in the Netherlands now is smaller than it used to be. Also, because governments, municipalities have been more strict on the rules. I mean, if the brothel owner doesn't follow the rules of the game, and if the girl, for instance, has no residence permit, or she doesn't pay tax, they have to pay tax.
Of course, it's a legal industry.
Yeah, it's a legal industry. Then the brothel is closed. So the number of brothels in Amsterdam at the moment is, I think, half of what it used to be. So it is a legal profession, but the rules are quite strict. We have to make it's a balance. We have to find a balance, because if we are too strict, the people will go underground.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want that. But I think overall the sex industry in the Netherlands has really become much smaller by now.
Is your aim to eventually eliminate the sex industry?
No, the goal is not eliminating. We don't address this from a moral point of view.
In Scandinavia, they criminalise the buying of sex, but it does not penalise sex workers. Do you think that works?
Yeah, I think the Swedish model is that they penalise the customer, mm-hmm. and not the sex worker. To be honest, we don't believe very much in that, because again, what happens? The customer will find his own or her own ways, mostly his ways, to find a sex worker. So he will go underground. He will find ways through internet very much beyond control and very much beyond the scope of work of health authorities.
And statistics and data is much easier for you to compile because it's a legal industry.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So that comes to me as well. In your line of work, you would have got opposition, as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to harm reduction, the whole agenda. How do you tackle that problem?
We started with that. I think we were the first country worldwide to start with harm reduction policies, even before the word existed, by providing methadone to heroin users in the 70s and early 80s. Heroin use was quite common in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam. And we failed, to be honest, because we didn't get ourselves organized well. Harm reduction is not that easy because it is a bottom-up approach. It's you need communities who have organized themselves. You need to create confidence or trust amongst the drug users to reach out to the government authorities who provide these services. And as I said before, normally a drug user is afraid of government and of law enforcement authorities. In the end, we put containers for clean needle exchange at a police station. That sounds very strange, of course.
It does.
But the goal was, and in the end we managed to achieve that, for the policemen to get to know the drug users and for the drug users to get to know the policemen, so that they got to know each other and felt that they were on the same line. And you see that happening in many, many countries. I had discussions today with the Chinese delegation, with the Indian delegation, and they're at the same, working on the same field, also trying to help law enforcement authorities, the police basically, and the whole justice system, to understand that criminalization doesn't help. There's much evidence, really very much evidence, that criminalization of drug use has not so many effects on the health and on drug use itself, whereas decriminalization and supporting people by providing them alternatives and at least reducing the risks on HIV, but also reducing the impact on society. For instance, think about petty crime, reducing the petty crime. That does help.
How did you get the public on board? I mean, these are targeted strategies to reduce as far as harm reduction is concerned. But how did you get the public at large to buy into this and understand what you were aiming to achieve with time?
Well, I think with harm reduction, it's not so difficult because you see the effects. I used to live as a university student in Amsterdam in the 80s, and my bike, we all ride bicycles.
Yes, as we found out yesterday.
Yeah, four times my bicycle was stolen, four times, by a junkie, by someone who was using drugs, because he needed the cash to buy heroin. After we introduced those harm reduction measures, it really ended. So I'm still riding the same bike which I had at the end of the 80s. So, I mean, at that time, I was not a professional, of course. I was just one of the people living in Amsterdam. So I think for the larger audience, and I'm sure in Kuala Lumpur you will see the same effect, people will see that petty crime has gone down. They will see that HIV is going down amongst this population. So I think for me that's the most convincing argument. And again, I can imagine people have a moral opinion about that. That's fine. But for me, evidence and the demonstration of how it works is as important.
You mentioned earlier there are three groups, three communities affected by HIV transmission and, where harm reduction is actually necessary. One is the drug users. Secondly, there's people involved in the sex industry. And the third being men having sex with men. What has been your experience with that community?
Yeah. Worldwide, we see that there's an increase of the HIV epidemics, especially among the last group, men who have sex with men. We don't say homosexuals because many men who have sex with men have a heterosexual relationship. They are married. That's why we use this term, terminology. And it's, of course, it's not an easy subject to talk about because there are strong feelings about homosexuality and about men having sex with men. At the same time, again, we think from a health perspective, it's important to have a pragmatic approach. Most governments actually do have that pragmatic approach, although maybe they will not be very open on it because it's not a very popular issue to discuss. But it's extremely important that governments tackle this issue because it's about public health. HIV amongst men who have sex with men is much higher than amongst the heterosexual population. But since these men have also have heterosexual contacts with their, for instance, with their wife or with their girlfriend, the risk of spreading of the epidemics to the generalized population, of course, is quite high. That's why I think governments really should take their responsibility, in spite of being this not a very popular subject. Now, that's from the health perspective. We also address this from the human rights perspective, because some people, especially transgender or men who have sex with men, really are facing a huge stigma and discrimination because of this subject being, you know, one of the subjects with high visibility, and people in general don't like the subject. But discrimination, if I asked someone on the street, are you in favor of discrimination? No. No one would say I'm discriminating. So I think discrimination is really the basis for all of us to work on. And I think a man who has sex with another man, or someone who uses drugs, or a sex worker, they all should have the same rights as other people in terms of having access to health services. Their life, for me, is as much worth as the life of anyone else. And so the human rights perspective for me is important as well.
When do you introduce sexual and reproductive health in schools? At what age? And how do you approach it?
Yeah, I remember when I was a schoolboy, I think I got, at biology when I was 11 years old, about sexual organs, but also about sexuality, what it is to fall in love with someone else, etc. There's strong evidence, actually, that it's more effective to start at an even younger age, when children are not so much focused on sex, of course, but they are focused on what it is, because they know their older brothers and their peers and their parents are talking about this issue, mm-hmm. and they have no clue.
And now with the internet.
And that's what I want to say, because yeah. I've got three kids myself. I wanted to have this discussion with them before they entered internet, because there's so much bad information, think about pornography, at internet, which is so easy to reach for them. So I really want to have them listening to my words, and at least give them some parental advice. And I don't mind if the teacher at school also provides them some information.
You can actually start with touch and things like that. I mean, in view of sexual abuse and all of that, and with amongst children, starting them young as far as what is the right touch and what is, you know, you can start like that and then move on.
And for instance, for a girl, what is it to say no? You have a right to say no if you're a girl. It sounds so easy, right? Yep. It sounds so logical, but in many societies, really, if I have this discussion with girls, they say, whoa, do you dare to say that?
You have every right to say that. Yeah. Sexual and reproductive health clinics seem to be perceived as feminine spaces. Why is this the case, and how have you changed that perception?
I very much disagree with that. I think the role of men in this subject is extremely important when it comes to sexual violence, for example, but also when it comes to the choice of contraception or the roles of men in the household. I don't believe in absolute gender equality, because we are different men and women. But at the same time, I do believe in more equality where possible. And I think speaking about roles in the household between men and women can have a good contribution to, for instance, reducing sexual violence. Now, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Sometimes we have the impression that other countries accuse us of being too liberal.
Yeah.
But I gave you an example at the very beginning of our conversation of the low abortion rates in the Netherlands. We have very low abortion rates in spite of very liberal abortion law. So when you liberalize your policy, that does not automatically mean that in this case you will have more abortions. On the contrary, we have very low teenage pregnancies because of the fact that we have a very liberal approach to sexuality. In the Netherlands, it's relatively easy to speak about sex and sexuality in the Netherlands at the household level or in church or at school. It's not only about sex, but it's about the sexuality. It's about being able to say no, for instance, as a girl or as a boy, or about being insecure, or about what it is to have a relationship. So I really want to emphasize that a liberal drugs policy in the Netherlands does not mean that we have many drug users. Actually, the drug use in the Netherlands is very, very low compared to other countries. And most people in my country use soft drugs, it's cannabis. It is a very limited use of hard drugs because we have separated those two circles. And it's something to think about, because in many countries the reaction is to oppress, to suppress, to criminalize, and we see what is the effect.
And you're a walking example of success in a larger picture, actually, more than looking at the micro level. Before we leave, I just want to know, in terms of creating a structure and sustainable change on sexual and reproductive health and rights, how do you create that structure? And if we were to start, okay, we've done relatively well, and I'm going to correct myself in terms of the transmission of HIV being largest amongst injectable drug users. It's no longer the case. Viva Raman of the Malaysian AIDS Council has corrected me. It has now moved because of our successful harm reduction programs amongst drug users. That has now reduced, and now it is sexual transmission that is the problem when it comes to the transmission of HIV/AIDS. So where do you think countries like Malaysia can, you know, start by changing structure to make this a sustainable plan going forward?
I have only one thing to say about this, that is sexuality education at schools should start at a large scale everywhere. Because then as a kid, before you become sexually active, you know more or less how to protect yourself, what are the risks of a sexual relationship, but also what are the good parts of it. So for me, education and being relatively open when it comes to speaking about sexuality is absolutely the answer to your question.
Your message on global challenges on sexual and reproductive health and rights. What would be your message?
Well, first of all, we should not have moral opinions. This is really, speaking about sexuality and everything related to sexuality is very personal. So, and I have to accept every person's personal view on it, like with society. Societies and cultures are so different from each other. We have to respect that from each other. So I don't buy a moral opinion on this. But let's see what we can learn from each other. There's a lot of evidence. There's a lot of scientific evidence. And I'm willing to share our experiences and the evidence which we have in my country. And I think on top of that, I think it's also good to look at the rights aspect. Let's provide people the right to health and the right to live the life to which they want.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Lambert Grinds, the AIDS Ambassador from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Netherlands, talking to us about the global challenges on sexual and reproductive health and rights on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.